this nightmare. And I know you and I both read that book, and it was just a terrifying ordeal. Mm-hmm. And so we were really proud. And I was very proud of what the things we were doing on the readout that stepped out of the basic. You know, we tried to really go deep on history, go deep on things that aren't comfortable to talk about, like Christian nationalism, white Christian nationalism, which really is plaguing our country. And when I would do that, I didn't do it from a point of view of, hey, this is the black lady talking about white Christians. I would have on Robbie Jones, who's my friend from Public Religion Research Institute, the foremost scholar on white Christian nationalism and himself a white Christian. Like, we really tried to be smart about doing deep dives on things that you see in the news and you're like, why is that happening? And try to make connections for people. So we did, I really genuinely didn't see it coming. None of my team did. And this leak happens the night of the sort of, I think it was the Friday night, this leak just drops. Dylan Byers, former CNN guy, former CNN guy who now does a Substack, I think, drops this leak. And we were just like, and I'm thinking that doesn't even seem right because I really just re-signed my contract. So, you know, I just signed again this year. So I couldn't really tell you, I can't explain what happened because I can't get in the heads of my bosses. But then I got the confirmation that Saturday and that was that.
Yeah. So look, I've never said this, but I'd just gotten the White House Correspondents' Dinner invitation from, you know, from management to go. And it's like, okay, this is cool, whatever. And then, let's see, I was sitting, Tim was out of town at a conference, and I was sitting in a restaurant by myself, and the monitors were on, and they made an announcement about Charles and Gail. And I'm like, oh, well, that came fast out of nowhere. That was really rushed.
Right.
And then I went back to work after that weekend, and that's when I went to work on a Monday, and then they called me after I was like, had already gone to work.
Wow.
And someone called me from the team, one of the crew guys, and said, you know, I wanted to tell you on Monday, I was wondering why they had taken your name off the wall of the studio.
Wow.
With all of the, and I didn't even know it. So other people knew before I did.
Wow.
Which was, yeah.
I think my the only reason other people quote unquote kind of knew before I did is because that leak, and I, you know, I'm very anti-leak. I don't leak. I try to be very careful about it. We're journalists, so we know not to talk to journalists. You know what I mean? Like, I'm very careful about that.
Yeah, I was like, Joy, what's going on? I'm hearing things.
I wouldn't leak to Don, and Don is my friend in real life.
You will not leak. She wouldn't say, I was like, Joy, what's going on? Talk to me. She goes, oh, I'm good. I'm like, okay.
I promise you all, Don and Don, like I said, we are friends. And I was like, I wouldn't even leak to Don. Like, I don't leak. I just don't do it. So when that leak came out, members of my team who read Puck or who are subscribed to it saw it and started panicking because, you know, it was so out of left field and out of the blue. And again, because we had just won the award and everything seemed so fine that, you know, there was nothing that had happened, nothing that had presaged it. So it definitely was out of the blue. And like you said, what happens is it starts to become a rumor, and you're not sure whether the rumor is real until you get the actual phone call saying it's real. And so you don't know really how to respond to it in advance of that. And it's just, it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate. I think that, you know, it's not the way I would have done things, but it is what it is.
Yeah. Well, you can't respond, like, contractually you can't respond.
I cannot.
We're not supposed to talk to the media, right? And so
and I don't.
Which actually I believe puts corporations or companies in a position, I think, well, it puts the employee in an unfair position because we can't defend ourselves. And then if you do defend yourself, they'll say, "Oh, you're leaking or you shouldn't be talking and you violated your contract." And it's like, and you know, a lot of the things that you read, most of what you read has been planted by people. And it is not necessarily true, but the people who write the first draft gets to write the narrative because everybody else, the reporters are lazy. They just go and they write the same story over and over. They don't even call for a comment. And it's like, and even if they do, you're like, I can't talk about it. So they end up believing what other people have planted and leaked about you, whether it's other people or whether it's a company or whether it's a PR, whoever it is. I'm just saying, I'm not
you
saying.
You don't know. Yeah. Because no one knows where they come from. I mean, only
I know where they come from.
I don't know. I don't know.
In order to get, let me be real. You want to get rid of a black woman at a company. I'm just saying any company. You want to get rid of a gay black man at any company, you have got to come up with a narrative and a predicate to do it, and you have to try to destroy them in order, because then you don't want people going, they're going to sue us for racism, and they're right. No, you have to try to destroy their personality and their credibility. And that's all I have to say. And you know, I'm going to tell it like it is, okay? And so I don't like that. I don't like it when that happens to people. I just think it's unfair. So I'm telling you, I'm not bitter. I don't think you're bitter, but just don't believe everything you read. And I wish the best for my colleagues at CNN. I love them. I miss them terribly. But the truth is the truth, and the truth will make you free. That's all I have to say. You didn't say it, I did.
I have no comment further about it. All I can really say is that one of the things that I do, that I have to say, and I think it is important to say, is you know, one of the great things about MSNBC that I will say something really positive is that the way that we all moved as friends, you know, Rachel, Nicole, Alex, Steph Rule, you know, Lawrence, the beloved Lawrence, we actually dig each other. Like, we actually really like each other. You know what I mean? And it's like, yeah. You can't fake that, you know? And I think it's so important that people understand that the on-air chemistry that you saw, Chris Hayes, all of us, when we're sitting around that set, you know, and all chilling, that was real. Like, we actually didn't fake that. You know what I mean? Like, we really are cool. We're actually still cool. We're friends. You know, it's a thing that is like a magic that can happen when executives are picking random people, right? And they're people who come from all different walks of life. We're different political parties, different political ideologies. It is actually a science and an art to put those people together and have them actually have chemistry, right? Like, you and I have chemistry because we know each other and we're cool and friendly. You can't invent that. Like, you couldn't make us pretend to be friends. You see what I'm saying?
I have
to give you know, the company, the, you know, it was, and it, at least in my era, you know, it was Phil Griffin who was in charge at that time. But you know, whatever. I feel like there was a magic that definitely happened at MSNBC that somehow caused all these very different, unique people to just have this great bond. And I think that's a beautiful thing. And I'm very proud to have been a part of that. I'm very happy to have been be able to experience that in my professional life.
Yeah.
Because I think that's a cool thing. You know, I'm still friends with some of my people from Radio 1 back in the day. You know what I mean? Some of my Radio 1 people, I'm still with them as well. Like, you can, when you create those kind of relationships, you know, Rev is my big brother, you know, then I knew him when we were on radio. So it's like,
I'm doing something for him for the NAND conference.
Yeah, exactly. Katie Fang, that's my girl. You know what I mean? Like, and even people who used to be there, Tiffany Cross, that's my sister. Yeah. It's like, you know, Melissa Harris Perry, that's my sister. Like, we've created these relationships that are real. And I think it's important to know that that's real. And don't feel like you were played to the left over the last, you know, was I there 14 years? You weren't. We really were cool.
Yeah. And I do have to say, look, when you work at an organization like a CNN and MSNBC, it really is an honor and a privilege to have been there. And it was great. Like, the best in the world. Yeah. CNN, it's like, if something happens internationally, it's over.
Listen.
MSNBC cannot compete with that. You know that, right?
Listen, Christiane Amanpour, I never met Christiane Amanpour until last year. Our show, we got nominated for an Emmy. I was so excited. So we went to the News Emmys, and Christiane Amanpour was there. And I was like, ooh. I'm like such a stan. Like, the way people would be if they saw Beyonce, that's how I am when I met Christiane Amanpour. I was like that the first time I met you. So you don't remember. I stand out on you. The first time I met you, David Wilson introduced us at an event. And you, I hope you don't remember, because I was embarrassing. I said, oh my God, Dolph Lemon, I'm such a big fan. You're probably like, get out. You're like, who are you, crazy
no.
weirdo? But I was like, Dolph Lemon, oh my God.
I'm old. I've been around. No, Joy, I've just been in awe of you, and I've watched your show, and I just go, wow, this is so well produced, and you were so bold, and I know people would get upset. And so, look, I have you, and we're going there, and people are going to write about it and talk about it. Did it have anything, let's just say yes or no. I don't want to answer. Do you think there was any racism involved?
I have no evidence of anything. I don't know. Okay. I have no evidence. No.
Do you think it was your support of Palestine? Not that you were anti-Israel, but was it, you think it any that had anything to do with it?
I have no idea. Like I said, I refuse to try to get into the brains of other people. I don't know. I genuinely have to be honest. I'm not making this up. I'm not spinning. I have no idea. I think they made a decision. The decision has been made. That's all I can say. People made a decision. The decision's been made. I don't know why.
I don't want to get you in trouble because I'm always the one to get in trouble. So I'm YouTube. That's my daily existence. Okay. The other thing is, can we talk about, because we love them, right? And they replaced you with some very talented people. And we love Simone. She's a friend, right? And we love Michael. And so nothing, this has nothing to do with them, Jonathan, or any of the other folks who are still there, right? We wish them well.
It doesn't matter what your goal is, making a resume, writing an essay, or drafting a cover letter. Grammarly takes your writing game.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and like I said, I had a show in 2014 called The Reed Report that was canceled.
I remember. It was you and what's his name? Oh, my. Ronan Farrow.
Roro. We called
your lead in, right?
Where Roro was my. I think I was his lead-in.
You were his lead-in.
Me and the, and we used to do this handoff. We used to want to go on Watch What Happens. We were like, we need to be on, like, they need to book us on Watch What Happens because we were such a sitcom because we, our handoffs became more and more extravagant. Oh, Joy, my friend, you are the light of my life. Oh, Ronan, you're the most brilliant young person I've ever met in my life. Like, once we started realizing how funny it was to people, we just started racking it up. I don't know why no one ever booked us on Watch What Happens. It really should have been.
Alex was on that same thing. Was she your lead? There was someone. It was you, Alex.
No, so the lineup used to be, because Alex Wagner was the noon show.
Right.
So Alex was at noon. I was at 2, because remember Tam was the 2 o'clock.
Oh my God.
Went to the Today Show, and she was such a huge supporter of why I got the 2. She was one of the people that really believed in me and supported me that I got the 2 and replaced her. So then it was Alex Wagner. She did the noon, and Michael Steele used to be a regular. I met Michael Steele on Alex Wagner's show. Because he was a regular guest. And so I used to spar with Michael Steele on there. She was the 12. I was the 2. And Martin Bashir. Remember Martin Bashir? Yeah. Martin was the 4, who was my other big supporter. And then the 5 and my buddy. And I'm still buddies with Martin. And then the 5 was, of course, Hardball, which was on the air, believe it or not. I think Hardball was on there for like 20 years. That was like the longest running show on MSNBC was Hardball. So back in the day, that was the dayside lineup.
I love it. I think it was SNL that used to do it. How about a hardball?
People used to compare me to Chris when I used to be on radio because I also go, ha! And so people would, whenever I would do that, people would be like, oh my God, you're the black woman, Chris Matthews. And it's just ironic that, you know, he really became a mentor to me. I do absolutely love Chris. Chris is a character. Like you would have to invent that character if he didn't exist. Like he just is a character.
Can we talk about the girl power? And I don't mean that as a pejorative, it's calling you girl, but between you and Rachel and, oh my gosh, why can't I'm having
and Nicole.
It? And Nicole. You guys were just the most brilliant and you had chemistry all together. It was fantastic.
Again,
you had a progressive, you had a conservative, and then, Rachel is progressive or whatever, and so in the middle. But what was that like working with, especially such a powerhouse like Rachel?
It was so fun, and just being able to watch her work, because you know I knew we were friends and we were friendly, but it's like we really got to watch her work up close. Her process, you know, her process is like intense. Like she's like Rhodes Scholar brilliance. You know, she's in there typing. You know, and we got to watch her do it, and of course, me and Nicole are cutting up trying to distract her while she's trying to type her opus. But no, it was one of those things. Again, I give Phil credit. I'm gonna give Phil Griffin credit. It was his brainchild, and then Rashida Jones expanded it and added the whole the full table. But it was one of those things that either would have really worked or it would have bombed. You know what I mean? Like you're taking 3 people, and it's weird because, you know, I knew who Nicole Wallace was because I quit the news business when I used to work at WTVJ, the Miami affiliate, because I was against the Iraq War. And I went and took Wellstone Action Training, the same training that Tim Walz took. I think he took it the year after I did. And I went and I worked as a press secretary for America Coming Together, which was George Soros' $260 million to try to oust George W. Bush, because I was deeply anti-war. Nicole Wallace was a big deal in the Bush campaign in 04. So we literally fought on opposite sides of that war. That's how opposite we were.
Then was she the press person or just an advisor?
Was an advisor. I think at that time she was on the press side, but I know I had heard her name. So I think because we were both press, but I was so low level. You know, she was way high above me. Then, of course, she went in the Bush White House. And so she was a very well-known, and she would be always on the shows. You'd see her. So I knew who Nicole Wallace was, but we didn't meet until she came to MSNBC. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Rachel is this, you know, sort of luminary who came from Air America. She was on the radio. I used to listen to her show. And so it's like, it's this interesting thing where you take these three very unlike people who are very different, and you just throw them together and just see what happens. And at first, Brian used to be the fourth wheel. And then it was just the three of us.
Oh, right.
Remember, it used to be the three of us. And Brian was at this other table. And Brian is so funny.
You know, Brian does impressions. I have a Brian. I haven't done it in a long time.
Okay, do it. Do your Brian Williams. You have to do it.
When Brian was, I worked at the NBC station. Oh, I worked with Brian. At first, I was at the network NBC in New York. And I was a correspondent in the New York Bureau. And I would fill in on MSNBC and on Weekend Today Show. And then and I remember Soledad and David were the anchors then.
Oh, my God.
And then I was there when David Blum died. And then, you know, Katie came in and whatever, and they woke me up in the middle of the night and said, David Blum died. You should be prepared to whatever when you come in. So, I mean, that was a long time ago, right?
Wow.
So I've been around
for
a while. But I used to do Brian because Brian, good evening. We would joke about when he was in Katrina. It was just a joke. This isn't real.
Yeah.
And so we would put our leg up on the desk and like we'd say, good evening. It's hot. It's wet. I'm wearing breathable khakis and I'm surrounded by black people. I love
that. Is so good.
We come to you tonight from New Orleans. It is hot. It's wet. And I'm surrounded by black people.
That is amazing. Like, actually, that is the most amazing
thing. Brian, I love you.
I love Brian. Can I just tell you, at that time that you were working with Brian, Brian used to come down every so often. Sometimes the big wigs would come to WTVJ when I was working in local news. Brian was the one guy who would come in and he would talk to everybody.
Yeah,
he was so friendly. Like, and I was a digital producer at the time. So I was the lowest of the low. No, I was like nobody. And he would walk right up to my desk and say, I can't do the voice. Hello, young lady. What do you do? And he was so nice. Like it was one of those things where you knew who this was. So you're like, this very famous person could either be really nice or they could be really an asshole. He was super nice. And he was nice like that to everybody. So I love Brian Williams.
Brian,
he was a hoot.
You know, the first person I really, Tom, I was there when Tom Brokaw was there. I used to file stories for nightly news and on the weekend because I was the new guy. Remember John Siegenthaler?
He
was
yes.
Yes, that's, I'm old. Damn.
Look, okay. I'm old and I'm old and I'm also a geek. The other time I geeked out, in addition to yourself, is when I finally met Ted Koppel, because Ted Koppel is the person who got me interested in news in the first place. Because I, in the sixth grade, I'm aging myself, when the Iran hostage crisis happened, I was watching a show about it, and they were calling it was like the 360 day, it wasn't called Nightline yet, but they were just covering it, and Ted Koppel was covering it on ABC News, and I got so obsessed with it. I was like, Mom, can I stay up and watch this? And she was like, okay, it's news, so you can do it. And I would sit up every night. I would watch the 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock news, and I would stay up and watch Nightline. And Ted Koppel was like my entry into fascination with news. It's how I knew who Bibi Netanyahu was and how I got really interested in Middle East issues, is that I would watch Bibi Netanyahu and Hanan Ashrawi, who was the leader of the Palestinian, right? Hanan Ashrawi. And I've actually now gotten to like text with Hanan Ashrawi, and I was like bugging out because I'm such a fan. But like, yeah, I would. And so Bibi Netanyahu to me was this guy who'd be on nightly, you know, on ABC. I'd see him with Ted Koppel debating Hanan Ashrawi, you know. And so it's like it's one of those things where if you're a news nerd, like, these are your celebrities, you know what I mean? So when I finally met Ted Koppel, I go up to him. He was inside 30 Rock. I see him standing there. This was ahead of the 2012 election, and I'm at the Griot. I was managing editor of the Griot. And I go up to him, and I said, oh, my God, Mr. Koppel, I'm such a huge fan. I tell him the story of how he got me interested in news. And he said, well, thank you so much, young lady. And look at your dimples. Those are priceless.
Oh, my God.
He complimented my dimples. I'm like, I feel kind of seen.
You know, we all have little stories like that. I remember I grew up idolizing Brian Gumbel, right? Brian's going to be mad at me, but because he's going to say, you make me
seem old.
I grew up idolizing and wanted to be him. I watched the Today Show with him and Jane Pauley, and then him later with Katie.
Too.
And I would record the opens to their show, and I would mimic them back, you know, whatever. Blah, 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 blah. And those are the stories. This Monday, July 25th, 1991. And then they would go, dun, 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 and I was like, I'm going to do that one day. I'm going to be like Brian Gumbel. And now Brian is like a really good friend. I went to dinner the other night. It's amazing to just have had the experiences that we've had in this business and more to come. And when you're in this independent business, so tell us, when you're in this independent journalism business, what's up? What's next for you? Where can we find you?
So right now you can find me at joyannereed.com. That is my Substack. I'm writing a daily read, R-E-I-D. You know, you see what I did there? It's like it's a read pun. I'm always got a read pun. I try to keep my husband's name out there. I'm doing the Substack right now and writing that every day. And I'm obviously still doing all my social media, but I am planning to do something like what you're doing right here, sir. And one of the things that I love about what you're doing, and I really enjoy, I am a lemonhead with all of the rest of the lemonheads out there. Because I think that this format is so smart and it is so accessible to people. And this is the future, right? Like, this is where it's going. And all we got to do is get my godmother and the other seasoned citizens to figure out how to use YouTube. And we end it.
Oh, my God. It's a learning curve. It really is a learning curve. But people will find you. Let me just tell you, you're going to do really well because you've got the personality. You've got the name recognition. You can do it. And you've got the gumption to be able to do this, right? As a young kid say, aura, you've got aura. So I think you're going to do really well. If I can offer you some advice.
Please, I need it.
Don't think about it too much. I had to wait a little bit before I could even do something. And so don't like try to make it perfect, too perfect. Don't let perfect, you know, be the enemy of the good. Just jump into it and do it. People like who you are. They like you like this in the t-shirt, you know, no makeup or whatever. They love it. So just do it. I started off, I spent a ton of money on a studio and lights and cameras. And my audience was like, no, we like you. I'm in my dining room right now.
Yeah.
They're like, we like you at home. And then, you know, when it's cold in the winter or whatever, I do it in front of the fireplace in my living room. So just do what you want to do, but don't wait too long. Yeah. It doesn't have to be perfect. And I would say to you, you've got to be fearless. You cannot give a fuck what people think about you, about what you're doing, because a lot of the folks who are, you know, in other places don't understand where this whole thing is going. And one day they're going to have to end up doing this. I feel late to the party already. And so, you know what I'm saying? And
I do too. Right.
And it's going to be like people coming out. They're like, oh, well, nobody cares anymore. But so do it. Get in now. The water is good. Get in.
Absolutely. And my husband is in a big I told you so on this, because he's been saying for years that this is like the future. This is the thing. But, you know, like I said, you and I both, we came from, you know, we both have done radio. I came from talk radio. I came from local news. You know, I come from this.
I used to be Tom Joyner, remember?
Yes, I used to listen to you on Dove. That's why I came up to you like a geek with David Wilson, because I used to listen to you. But it's like these experiences I actually think are great preparation for this, because radio to me is the most equivalent to both cable and this, right? Yeah. Because talk radio, and what I used to love about talk radio, and shout out James T. Thomas, my mentor, James T., who I worked for, and I was his producer, and then I became his co-host, and he's just a huge and wonderful mentor to me. And the reality is, what I love the most about talk radio, and I think what you love the most about doing this, Don, is the interaction with the listeners. Because we used to take calls. Baby, I used to love to take a call, especially the crazy ones. Right. Like, some people used to call us and we would just debate them back and forth, and it was just so interesting.
But you can do it now. Look at your screen. Do you see what's on your screen?
I can barely see it because my screen is small where I'm
looking. Comments are right here. It's like, and you're right. This is, it's like radio.
Yeah.
You have to, you're going to have to come up with things. People are like, it's so easy when they come off of like, you know, traditional TV or whatever. They'll say, it's so easy. I used to do TV live 2 to 3 hours a day. I'm like, it's not that easy.
Not the same.
It's not the same. because you don't have three producers to do and hair and makeup and someone putting on your light. And you walk into a studio that's already lit with camera equipment and production people. You know what I'm saying? It's not that easy.
Well, one thing I'm going to say, Don, and I'm just going to say, this is the difference between the men's and the women. Baby, I'm going to have hair and makeup on, though. I'm not going to add hair because I took off my hair. But, baby, we going to be made up. You know what I mean?
Nothing.
I'm on my day off today. That's why
nothing. There's nothing. No
and we
makeup.
Friends. So I'm like, we cool like that. But, I'm going to have to probably get some hair and makeup.
Well, you look good. Don't overthink it. But I love you. You're going to be great. And congratulations. I'm sorry it had to happen this way. And, you know, I can relate. But
one thing I'm going to say, Don, and I'm just going to say, this is the difference between the men's and the women. Baby, I'm going to have hair and makeup on, though. I'm not going to add hair because I took off my hair. But, baby, we going to be made up. You know what I mean? I'm on my day off today. That's why
nothing. There's nothing. No
and we
makeup.
Friends. So I'm like, we cool like that. But, I'm going to have to probably get some hair and makeup.
Well, you look good. Don't overthink it. But I love you. You're going to be great. And congratulations. I'm sorry it had to happen this way. And you know, I can relate, but it's you're good. You're going to be good, my friend.
Thank you, my friend. I appreciate you. And look, you and I think you feel the same way, because I feel like what you did at CNN, paved the way for me. There haven't been too many Black folks who've been able to do it. We now do have, you know, two sisters that are doing it, at CNN. Abby Huntsman, my soror, is doing it as well. And so, you know, but it's new, right? I remember the first time I met Gwen Ifill in 2015, I was in Selma covering the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. And I saw her across the street. And just like how, you know, I love Bryant Gumbel too. I can just picture you were in New Orleans and I was in Denver and we were both at home watching the same Today Show episodes, you know, and at the same time, I just didn't know we would ever be friends. But, you know, Gwen Ifill was the only Black woman. She was one of only two Black women. Carol Simpson and Gwen Ifill were the only Black women I really ever saw. And the only other person of color was Connie Chung. So I loved all three of them. And I remember Gwen Ifill was the one who looked the most like me. You just didn't really see a brown-skinned Black woman with short hair. I was like, this woman is like me. And so when I saw her in person for the first time in 2015, when I tell you I ran across the street without seeing if a car was coming, I could have got licked down by a car, but I ran to Gwen Ifill with my arms open like, Gwen Ifill, oh my God, I'm such a fan. And she could have been like, get away from me, crazy ass, get away. But instead, she opened her arms, she wrapped me up in a big hug. She recognized me from having been a frequent guest on Melissa Harris Perry's show. So she knew I wasn't a stalker. And she gave me a hug and she said, she gave me so many words of encouragement. She was so kind. She was so encouraging. And she was exactly what you would want Gwen Ifill to be. She was really an idol to me. Love her so much. And of course, her cousin, Sherilyn, is equally amazing. And it's like, that's the kind of affirmation that you get that tells you you're doing the right thing, that you're in this business for a reason. And I definitely feel like God put me on this earth to do this, to try to make it make sense for people, this horrible, complicated mess that is our country. And I think, and God put you on this earth for that reason too, Don. And so we got to do what God has instructed us to do.
Look, I borrow from folks, you know, so I borrowed from Bryant Gumbel, you know, I call it borrowing. I borrowed from Wendy Williams. Like, Wendy would sit there and just like, sit in her windiness and whatever. You can
I love her. Yeah.
She's very talented. She's a very talented
one of the best to ever do it.
Because she was on radio.
Yeah.
She's really good. And people don't give her credit because they think, oh, she was a gossip, whatever. And a lot of folks don't like her because she gossiped about them. But just her talent to be able to do what she did, I recognize that. You know, I stole Hot Topics from her. She stole it from borrowed.
Borrowed.
She borrowed it from Barbara Walters. Who else did and then I remember Gwen Ifill, I went to, I think it was my first NABJ convention back in the day, and I had this little tape, and I went there to you know, when you go and to the job fair, right?
Yep.
And they review your tape, and she looked at me, she goes, oh my God, you're so good. She goes, how did you learn to read the teleprompter like that? And I was like, Gwen Ifill. She was gassing me up, but she made me feel good, like I could do it.
Yeah.
And just the little things, amazing. And we have so many people. Remember, we stand on the shoulders of people like her and our ancestors who've been here.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Max Robinson and the Bryant Gumbels of the world and the Gwen Ifills of the world.
Yes.
And let's not forget about Sue Simmons. I love
Sue Simmons.
Sue Simmons, by the way. You see what's on the screen, Live at Five. That was from Sue Simmons.
Sue Simmons, baby. And she did. Look, I love her. She's the most fearless DGAF sister in the media business ever. I love her.
Yeah.
Love her.
I love you too. Okay, so catch Joy.
It's a love fest.
JoyAnnReed.com, Substack, and then also her social media. And then make sure you stay tuned. She will be doing something in the digital space, streaming, whether it's YouTube or whatever it is that you're planning.
It's going to be YouTube. I can give you that little tea that it will be on YouTube because I want people to be able to watch the Don Lemon show and then watch me. We're going to make sure we stagger it because we don't want people to have to choose. So, I'm going to avoid the times when you on. We're going to make sure that we stagger.
Yes, do what you do. Establish a relationship with your audience. At first, I was doing 3 episodes a week, canned interviews. And then I said, I want to talk to people. I'm going to do a show in my living room and I'm going to grow my community. And you will do it. It's different than TV, but you'll see.
Amen. I'm excited about it. I actually am really excited about it. And like I said, I'm keeping one hand out on my team. So if anybody is looking for great producers out there, if you know folks that are hiring, I'm sure they're probably hiring inside internally too. They'll all be fine. But yeah, I just miss my people. But other than that, I'm very excited about it.
Hope in the midst of an overwhelming situation.
I let go of trying to control things that I had no control over, and that helped me find peace of mind.
Alcoholism is a disease that can affect any family. Everyone suffers, but there is help and hope at Al-Anon Family Groups.
I was constantly stressed and worried. Now I approach each day with joy and gratitude.
In Al-Anon, families and friends of alcoholics find new ways to heal from the effects of a loved one's drinking.
Al-Anon gave me my life back. I'm a better father and husband.
Are you in an overwhelming situation because of someone else's drinking?
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Local and virtual meetings are available. Maybe one could work for you. For information, call 1-866-200-0033 or visit alanon.org/hope.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. Armando Rayo, host of the Tacos of Texas podcast. Season 4, El Cuatro, is done. This season, we talked about vaquero culture, went inside HEB's Mi Tienda, and talked about the staples of border food culture. If you're looking for something to listen to over the holidays, you can listen to all the episodes of the Tacos of Texas podcast on KUT.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
First off, why I wanted to be on, I mean, it's Shark Tank. You know, it's the Super Bowl of being an entrepreneur. Okay. Everybody wants to be on Shark Tank. Millions of people see your business. It blows up your brand. It makes you feel more official. And it's also just good for your company. People buy your stuff. They download your app. They recognize you and become a brand in yourself. And I always felt like growing up watching the show, I felt like I would kill it in that. I'm confident. I love to talk. And I'm witty. And I always knew as a kid I wanted to be on it. And then, 16 years old, I told my mom, I'm going to be on this show. And when I am, I'm going to bring you on it with me. And so, flash forward a decade. I was 16, I'm 26 now. Flash forward a decade. Funny enough, this is another thing that people don't know. I didn't even apply to be on Shark Tank. Somebody from Shark Tank reached out to me.
Dustin G. Bell, co-founder and CEO of Cardio. Bell was recently featured in the first episode of season 16 of the ABC TV hit show Shark Tank to promote his fitness app. Cardio is a gamified movement app turning outdoor cardio into a community-based game of team turf war. Users can join a former team and claim or steal an area of town they walk, run, or bike through from other players in their city, all while still tracking stats like miles, pace, distance, and calories burned. As a child growing up in Louisville, Kentucky, Bell knew three things. He was broke, he wanted to make money, and he had a problem with authority. These three things led him down the path into entrepreneurship, starting with selling candy at school at age 11 and graduating from the University of Kentucky with a degree in marketing in May of 2020. I'm Johnny O. Hansen, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, the Cardio Fitness app with co-founder and CEO Dustin G. Bell in Black America.
I didn't expect to get a deal, or if I did, I didn't think it was going to be a deal I liked or from a shark that I wanted. So I wanted to just make sure that no matter what happens, we're just going to air. The episode is going to make it to TV. And then the second one was, of course, to get a deal. You know, I want a deal. I want good terms. I want to be sharks who can be valuable to the company. And then the third one was get my mom to be on TV with me, which I don't know if we're going to talk about that a little bit later, but I was able to finesse that one at the end. But, you know, they're way more important than just the money that they got. And I mean, even off of that, I've had so many people reach out to me independently. I've had people who wanted me to do speaking engagements and gigs, talk to their students, mentor them. I've had people, you know, pay for me to do those things, which has never happened to me before. And then on top of that, you know, for the business, it was great. You know, we got thousands of downloads within a day.
With limited job opportunities after graduating from the University of Kentucky during the pandemic, Dustin G. Bell found himself sleeping on the couch in his father's attic and losing motivation to work out or engage in outdoor cardio. During this time, he came up with an idea for a fitness software. After reflecting on how Pokemon Go gained popularity and demonstrated that those who would not have normally been outside were more willing to do so in a gamified way. Fast forward, he decided to pack up his belongings and move to Austin, Texas, without a job, family, or place to stay. Bear was recently featured in the first episode of season 16 of Shark Tank. He asked the Sharks for $150,000 in exchange for 5% equity in his company, valued it at $3 million. He secured a deal for $150,000 in exchange for 15% equity in his company. Of course, after this episode aired, the company gained a lot of attention and more people started using the Cardio app. In Black America recently spoke with Dustin G. Bell in studio.
Well, you know, from a young age, I always knew that I liked where I lived. But it was mostly because of the people I was there with, you know, my family, my friends, all my childhood memories are from there. But as I got older, I realized that the things I want to do in my life, they're really not the place. They're not going to happen here at the level I want them to. You know, Kentucky is known for bluegrass, bourbon, horses, Mitch McConnell, a lot of things that aren't really my thing. So I figured, you know, eventually at some point I want to move to a place that's a little bit more opportunistic for what I want to do with my life. And, you know, that ended up being Austin. Obviously, I love living here. And Louisville was cool, you know, young in my youth anyway. I'm still young. Some people would say I feel old. Just spent a lot of time playing sports, hanging out with family, friends. And, yeah, I can't really complain too much. It made me the man I am today. But, yeah, you know, grateful to be in Texas now.
So how did you select the University of Kentucky to attend college?
You know, I'm going to be honest with you. I selected them because they gave me the most scholarship money.
Okay.
But beyond that, I knew I wanted to get out of Louisville. I lived there my whole life, like I said. And I always knew I wanted to expand my horizons. And, you know, an hour down the road isn't that far of an expansion. But it was at least something. At that point, I lived in Louisville my whole life. I never lived anywhere else. It was the first time I lived outside of Louisville for an extended period of time. And the University of Kentucky has been very kind to me. They've been some of my biggest partners, investors. Most of my mentors, a lot of my friends who I still hang out with to this day, went there with me. So, I mean, it was a great college. I appreciate and I love my time there, and I think of it very highly and favorably still.
What were some of your favorite subjects while you're at the University of Kentucky?
You know, that's a hard question to answer because I didn't go to a lot of class. I did the bare minimum to make sure I didn't lose my scholarship. I was more interested in the extracurricular things like clubs and networking events and business opportunities and stuff like that outside of class. But I'm a marketing guy, so I really enjoyed some of my marketing classes. I love doing sales exercises and competitions and classes that really got to dive into tangible skills. I've never been good with classes where you're just told to remember terms and then hopefully on the exam you fill in the right bubble on the Scantron for the definition of that abbreviation. That's never been interesting to me, but something where I can do actual tangible activities that I can see having, you know, follow through into my adult life when I actually start working and trying to build a career. Those are the kind of classes that stuck with me the most.
When did you develop the mindset that you wanted to be an entrepreneur?
I knew from the get-go. I remember my mom told me when I was 5 years old, I would take my old toys and I would try to flip them to the neighborhood kids. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we were flipping toys at 5 years old. People. Once I was done with my Spider-Man toys, I figured I'd sell it to somebody else. I didn't really understand market dynamics that much. So I was trying to sell toys. You could get retail for like $15 for 50. So it didn't work that well. But I always had this desire to try to find a dollar out of an activity. When I got into middle school and high school, you know, the usual things kids do, shoveling snow, cutting grass, selling candy, a whole bunch of things. I even used to ghostwrite people's essays and their English homework and stuff like that because I was a good writer and I knew people didn't enjoy it and they weren't as good as I was. And I used to charge people by the page to write essays and stuff for them during class, even some of their scholarship essays. I got a lot of people paid. And going into college, I started my first legitimate company. It was a marketing company called Life Off You, working with a whole bunch of brands off campus to get students interested in what they got going on. We worked with brands like Sky Zone, Lyft, the local mall, local movie theater, and all that around transacting with students and their companies and taking a percentage of the fees. And that was my first legit business. The first thing I had operations, a P&L, cash flows, all those types of things. And I realized I really love this game. I really would want to do this for the rest of my life. And I've been very fortunate to say that since I graduated college, I've been a full-time entrepreneur since. And it's something that I just love. Ain't always easy, ain't always fun, but it's always something I would do.
Prior to you becoming an entrepreneur full-time, you had a corporate job. Talk to us about that.
Well, that's the thing. I never had a corporate job.
Well, you had it for a while.
No, genuinely. I never had a 9-to-5 job my entire life. I had a internship as a junior going into my senior year that summer. I had a corporate internship as a sales rep. It sucked. Mm-hmm. I hated it. And I told myself I would never do that again unless I was destitute. And so I moved to Austin. And, you know, the bad thing about moving to Austin, the time I did, which is October 2020, was it was middle of COVID. Couldn't find a job. I was living out of my car, hotel, Airbnb, just finding dollars wherever I could, doing a whole bunch of random gig work. I was doing some social media marketing for companies. I was helping build websites. I was buying and trading crypto and stocks, day trading and whatnot. And I was very fortunate in making the right investments, starting the right companies before this one I'm working on now, Cardio. Before I was working on Cardio, I started two different companies that were pretty successful. One is a content creator working with the NBA, Old Spice, McDonald's, a bunch of other different brands around helping them with content. And then also a second company working with remote employees to help them connect with each other better by stimulating water cooler talk, as the old folks would say, mm-hmm. for people who are on Slack. And I've been very fortunate to say that I've done, between the fact that I live very lean, you know, we were eating rotisserie chicken out of the Walmart deli every day, so I didn't need a lot of money. But between being very fortunate with some of my early ventures and investments, and then also living very lean and not needing a ton of money to survive, I never had to take a corporate job a day in my life.
So why Austin?
Land of opportunity. I was living in Kentucky, middle of COVID. I didn't really enjoy my time there that much even before COVID. After COVID, it was even worse. I had just graduated college, and I was wondering, what are the opportunities that exist for me out there in the real world outside of Louisville, Kentucky? And I had been reading all over the place on blogs and articles, on podcasts, on Reddit threads, YouTube videos. Austin, 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 Austin. You're a young person in tech. Austin, you're a guy who wants to be in fitness. Austin, you want to buy real estate. Austin, you want to go somewhere and have a good time as a 20-year-old bachelor. Austin. So I'm like, all right, you know what? All the roads keep going towards Austin. They can't all be wrong. Like, some of these have to be true. And so I just genuinely got in my car one day. I packed my car up with as much stuff as one can fit in a 2007 Kia. Not a lot. And I just drove to Austin from Kentucky one day. It wasn't a spur of the moment decision, because I had been thinking about it for the longest time. But whereas a lot of people move because they got a job, or they're going to college, or they got a buddy or something like that, I didn't have any of those things. I just said, you know what? I can always find an excuse, or I can just do it. So I'm just going to get in my car and just go. And you know, never regret that decision.
When did you come up with the idea for Cardio?
I got the idea at the same time. I was stuck at home during COVID like everybody else. You know, you guys can't see me, but I lift a lot of weights. I'm a fairly in shape guy, in my humble opinion. Lifting weights is never an issue for me. I like push-ups, I like crunches, I like bench pressing, I like squats. I don't love running, and especially during COVID when, you know, this is before run clubs were the big thing. This is before, you know, running was this huge thing that people were picking up. It was something that, you know, you had to do by yourself, and especially as a non-competitive athlete, I didn't really ever run for anything when I was younger, except for training for basketball. Once I realized I'm going to be 5'8 forever and the NBA was not in my cards, I stopped running because it just wasn't that beneficial to me anymore. And then during COVID, whereas I usually would play basketball with friends, go hike, do all these things to get it kind of vicariously, I couldn't do any of those activities anymore. And I realized, well, dang, I still got to do my cardio. Mm-hmm. How can I make it enjoyable enough that I would want to do it every day? And the idea came to my mind because Pokemon Go was seeing this big resurgence. They were seeing this huge resurgence in interest and whatnot from people during COVID. And I wondered, could you make Pokemon Go a cardio fitness app? And that was where the idea originally originated from.
So when you came up with the idea, obviously one has to make the app. So who were part of your team in getting to where you are right now?
Yeah, a lot of people. So the funny part is that I talk to people all the time. They're like, yo, how'd you go about executing on this? You know, what skills did you have? What experience did you have? I had none, you know. I'm not an engineer. I went to school for marketing, so I didn't know how to build apps. I never designed apps. I had no money. I was not a runner, so I didn't have a vast experience with running apps. I had never led a team of engineers. I also had no money because I was basically making enough to survive. So it was definitely not enough for me to pay, you know, some $10,000 a month for engineers. So I sent a ton of DMs. I sent about 400 DMs over a three-ish month span to
a bunch of DM.
Yeah. Oh, my bad. A direct message. That's what the kids
okay.
get.
Right.
get you. But a direct message to a bunch of engineers on LinkedIn asking them to, hey, basically quit your job and work with me for free. And all of them said no, obviously, because they're not, you know, idiots. So they all said no. But one of them, you know, connected me with the founder of Pokemon Go. Mm-hmm. And so I reached out to him, sent him a message. He responded. And then long story short, we ended up getting a $50,000 investment from him and his team at Pokemon Go. And then with that, I was able to then convince my CTO to quit his job. Funny enough, he was working at LinkedIn, DM on LinkedIn, got him to leave LinkedIn through LinkedIn. It's funny, but got him to quit his job. And then he worked with me, and he's the person who built the original app.
I understand. You're listening to In Black America with John L. Hanson Jr. We'll be back with more of our conversation in just a moment.
Armando Rayo, host of the Tacos of Texas podcast. Season 4, El Cuatro, is done. This season, we talked about vaquero culture, went inside HEB's Mi Tienda, and talked about the staples of border food culture. If you're looking for something to listen to over the holidays, You can listen to all the episodes of the Tacos of Texas podcast on KUT.org or wherever you get your podcast.
If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny Johansson Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with Dustin George Bell, co-founder and CEO of Cardio. You recently was profiled on the first episode of season 16 for Shark Tank. Talk to us. Why did you want to be on the program?
First off, why I wanted to be on, I mean, it's Shark Tank. You know, it's the Super Bowl of being an entrepreneur.
Okay.
Everybody wants to be on Shark Tank. Millions of people see your business. It blows up your brand. It makes you feel more official. And it's also just good for your company. People buy your stuff. They download your app. They recognize you and become a brand in yourself. And I always felt like growing up watching the show, I felt like I would kill it in that. I'm confident. I love to talk. And I'm witty. And I always knew as a kid I wanted to be on it. And then 16 years old, I told my mom, I'm going to be on this show. And when I am, I'm going to bring you on it with me. And so flash forward a decade. I was 16. I'm 26 now. Flash forward a decade. Funny enough, this is another thing that people don't know. I didn't even apply to be on Shark Tank. Somebody from Shark Tank reached out to me.
Okay.
And asked, hey, man, I saw you on somewhere. He didn't even remember where he said he saw me, but he saw me somewhere and said, yeah, I like this kid. I like his app. I like his energy. I like his persona. I think he'd be good on camera. I think he'd be a fun guy to have on. And so he reached out to me. I initially thought it was a scam because, you know, just why would somebody reach out to me? It's like, you know, the prom queen reaching out to like the wallflower nerd and asking him to dance. You know, that's not how this works. It's supposed to be the other way around, you know? So I didn't believe it. But then after I did my due diligence, realized he was legit, reached out back to him. We had a chat. He, you know, expedited me through the application process. That in itself was, you know, several months of back and forth on things I needed to get approved from legal, getting the app ready, preparing the pitch, thinking about who I needed to pitch to, what I needed to say. So it was a process. It was not easy. It was not always fun. But finally, we got on. We filmed the episode back in June. And then, you know, obviously, we closed the deal with two sharks. That was awesome, getting Damon John and then another guy, Rashawn Williams, guest shark. But awesome dude, you know, early investor in Coinbase, DoorDash, Lyft, minority owner for the Atlanta Falcons. Both very successful, powerful black men who I look up to. So getting them to be, you know, part of this journey with me and give me advice and the money, of course, was a great opportunity for me. And then, you know, now that the episode is out, we were on the season premiere. We were the headline pitch of the season. People still tell me to this day they see my face on commercials on ABC during College Game Day and stuff like that because they've been running my episode as part of their advertising campaign for the season. You know, it's a very surreal feeling, and it was something that I envisioned for almost a decade up to that point. So actually having it happen and it being such a big success was, you know, dream come true.
Now, prior to that, when you went on the program, was there amount of money that you was looking for versus equity in your company?
Yeah, so, you know, the main thing that they make you do on Shark Tank, of course, is pitch and say, I want this much money for this percentage of my company, right? So I went in there initially asking for $150,000 for 5%. Now, the thing is, I've watched a lot of Shark Tank in my day, John, and I knew going into it I was not going to get the number that I asked for.
Right.
I just knew that. So I came in asking for 150 at 5. I knew I wasn't going to get it. I actually wanted like 150 at 10 or 15. And I knew if I asked for that up front, they was going to walk me down at 20, 25. So I knew, let's start at 5. They might say 25. I'll meet them at
15. Work your way to 15, guys.
Now, what was funny about it is that they initially countered 150 at 15% immediately. Now, the thing is, that was the number I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And so I immediately wanted to be like, deal, we're done. It's over. Bye. But I realized, all right, we got to make good television. So I counted. I made a fake counter. I didn't even care. I'm like, what about 10%? And it was so funny. Like, Mark Cuban lost his mind. Oh, Destin, no. Oh, you blew him. You know, Kevin O'Leary, Mr. Wonderful, he's killing me. He's like, oh, your mom's watching the episode right now saying you should have took the deal, bozo, and And I'm not going to lie, I was freaking out. They did a really good job of cutting me to look good. As the kids say, I would have lost a little bit of aura because I, unfortunately, freaked out a little bit. I will acknowledge. I'm like, whoa, hey, my bad. You know, how about 17.5%, 20%? You know, I feel bad. But, you know, we ended up coming to a really good deal at 150 at 15%. And, you know, getting a buy one, get one for Sharks is a deal I like. I used to get buy one, get one Twix bars at, you know, Family Dollar. I think buy one, get one for Sharks is a lot better. So I'm happy with the deal I made.
Now, when you look at the deal that you make, obviously the money is important, but also advertising your brand and having access to these two individuals is worth more than what they gave you.
Oh, exponentially. 150 grand in the grand scheme of things isn't a lot of money. You know, we had already raised about 300,000 the same month that we went on that show. So the money was never the biggest thing. You know, I had several different tiers of how I thought about it. The first tier was just to get on and make good TV. Because one thing that people don't know about Shark Tank also is that there are 160-ish companies, maybe even more than that, that actually go in film. And only about 80 of them will actually make TV. So beyond the process of how difficult it is to even get to the point where you film Shark Tank, to actually get on TV is also like another 50-50. It's a flip of a coin if you're even going to make TV. So my first focus, going back to why I counted at 10%, even though I was cool with 15, is just to make good television. Because I didn't expect to get a deal, or if I did, I didn't think it was going to be a deal I liked or from a shark that I wanted. So I wanted to just make sure that no matter what happens, we're just going to air. The episode is going to make it to TV. And then the second one was, of course, to get a deal. You know, I want a deal. I want good terms. I want to be sharks who can be valuable to the company. And then the third one was get my mom to be on TV with me, which I was able to finesse that one at the end. But, you know, they're way more important than just the money that they got. And I mean, even off of that, I've had so many people reach out to me independently. I've had people who wanted me to do speaking engagements and gigs, talk to their students, mentor them. I've had people pay for me to do those things, which has never happened to me before. And then on top of that, you know, for the business, it was great. You know, we got thousands of downloads within a day, and then we just kept that momentum running. Even now, it's been like almost 3 weeks since the episode aired, and we're still seeing these residual tailwinds. We had people from CNBC and Forbes and Blavity and Afrotech and all these different places reach out to us, want to use our app, got all these new opportunities from it. I mean, just across the board, it has been a huge opportunity beyond getting the money and getting the sharks, just being on TV, and then not only having those two people give us money, but then also make phone calls on my behalf, connect me to people, and then put their brand with mine to make me look more legit. And when I reach out to people, instead of them leaving me on red, they call me. It's a very solid feeling. It feels great.
Talk to us about having your mom on television.
Yeah, my mom is a really important person to me. You know, when I was growing up, I wasn't always as polished as I presented you today,
yes,
John.
Sir. Yes, sir.
it took me a little bit. You know, I had a lot of smoothing out on the edges over the years, and my mother was one of the very first people to invest in me, because a lot of people saw me as a troublemaker, bad grades, cut school, get in fights, get suspended at school, all these different types of things that I did when I was younger. My mom always saw past that, you know, he's different. You know, he's not a school. He's not an academic. He doesn't care about things he doesn't care about. He's not good at homework, but he's a smart kid. He's not good at listening, but he's good at talking. and she invested in the things that I was really good at. And, you know, when I was 16, like I said, you know, my mom, me and her were watching Shark Tank every week. I used to have a really bad lisp and a stutter. I wasn't a very good public speaker back then. And my mother told me at a young age that a guy like you who wants to talk as much as he does needs to be good at it. And one of the things that we did to improve my speaking was watch Shark Tank. That was the reason we started watching it. Even before I was really legitimately interested in business, we would watch Shark Tank just so I could learn how to present my ideas succinctly, charismatically, persuasively, and all that type of stuff. And when I was 16, I said, yo, I actually want to be on this show. I made the decision I want to be on it. Me and my mom, we were locked in. Every time I've done a business event, my mother has, to the best of her ability, always supported it. Whether it was $50 to do this, or it was her flying to Austin to help me with that, or if it was me calling her at 1 in the morning and asking, yo, mom, what do you think about this? My mom has always been there for me. So when it came time for me to actually be on Shark Tank, I made sure to the best of my ability that she would be there. Now, here's the funny part. Shark Tank was actually extremely against it at first, because they said you can only be on with people who are equity partners in your business. Mm-hmm. I know she's your mom and she's your rock and she's your confidant and your pseudo chief of staff, but she's not actually, so she can't come. So when we flew, because we flew to LA to film the episode, when we flew to LA, they told me that she couldn't come unless we paid for her out of pocket. So I'm like, screw it. So we paid for her. And then at first, they're like, leave her at the hotel. And I said, oh, well, could I bring her to the green room with me at least? I don't want her to just be waiting. I could be here for hours. Yada, yada. And I said, okay, fine. She can come to the green room. And then when we get to the green room, I'm like, oh, but wouldn't it be cool if before the episode started, she was with me in the lobby? We give a little prayer. We hug each other. We say some kind words. You know, it's a family show. It's a family business type deal. And like, that's actually a great idea. Let's get makeup, hair. Let's put some cardio gear on her. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then as I go in there, if you watch the episode, I was planting the seeds. Again, my first goal, make good TV. My second goal, get some money. Third goal, get my mom on TV. So one and two were going pretty good. But throughout the process, I was like, all right, I need to sprinkle my mom in here. Mm-hmm. So when Lori, one of the other sharks on the show, Lori was out very early, and I just threw in, oh, by the way, Lori, my mom says you're her favorite shark. Oh, you guys are tied for second, but Lori, you're her favorite. Oh, that's cute. Nah. Then later, when they ask, like, you know, what's your why? Why are you here? Why do you want to do this? I'm like, oh, well, you know, my mother, I want to create generational wealth. I want to be able to provide for her and my kids and anybody else in my family who's been there for me. And my mom is back there right now waiting for me to get a deal, and I'm not leaving without one. And they're like, oh. And then they said, oh, 15%. I'm like, ooh, can I ask my mom what she thinks about it? And then they say, oh, well, go get your mom. Go get your mom. Bring her in the tank. Let's see. Let's ask her directly. So I said, and they cut this part, but I literally said, oh, bleep. Like, for real? I broke character for a moment. And then I got to bring her out on the Shark Tank. You know, everybody got to see her and talk to her. And, you know, we got to have that big moment where we embrace and talk to each other. And, you know, we got to hug Damon and Rashawn together, take some group photos. It was an awesome experience. It was honestly a dream come true. I think that was honestly more meaningful to me than getting a deal and being on TV was getting to do it with my mom.
I heard that. Dustin, before we run out of time, how does the deal with Shark Tank affect your other investors?
Well, I'll be honest, they're not the best terms for everybody else. They definitely talked about, you know, what it looks like for future rounds and their investment and their dilution and whatnot. But they also recognize that a small piece of something is better than a big piece of nothing. You know, Shark Tank is an investment in your business that might not, on an economic level, on a blind taste test, be the best thing that you ever had. But the exposure and the opportunity and then also the collaboration of having those sharks, that in itself is worth so much more than the equity they gave up. And at the end of the day, the person who lost the most equity is me. That was 15% of my baby. You know, y'all got 2% here and 8% there. I used to have 100%.
Okay.
It was 100% all of me before y'all got here. And I've been allowing people to whittle away at my pie throughout this journey. But I'm willing to do that because I recognize that even if I walk away with 12% of this, but we sell it for $100 million, I'm going to make a lot more than I would at some corporate sales job at Oracle. No offense to Oracle. They use my app and I love Oracle a lot. But I don't want to be an SDR at Oracle. I want to build an app that Oracle uses for their employees and I get paid to do so. And, I'm willing to make those caveats.
Talk to us about the app itself. What does it do?
Yeah, so Cardio is a gamified movement app. It turns your outdoor walking and running into a giant team game of turf war. So let's say that you're walking around UT's campus and you're on Team UT. As you walk around all the buildings and schools and all these other areas around campus, you would track your mile pace, your distance, your calories, your route, the locations and landmarks you move past. But that area, almost like a game of capture flag, would be captured for your team by you moving through it. Other teams, let's say Texas A&M, for instance. If a person from Texas A&M decided to make the drive from College Station and do a run around UT's campus, they would steal UT's campus from Team UT. Whoever walked that area before them would get notified, oh, this person stole this area from you, and the only way to get it back so go out there, walk, run, crawl, cartwheel, whatever it is that you want to do to move. And the idea is to add this layer of social dynamicism and gamification on top of the outdoor walking and running that people should be doing to hopefully make it a more enjoyable experience for them. Like I said, the idea of it was if Pokemon Go was a running app.
Obviously, there's been some highs. Talk to us about the lows and getting to where you are right now.
I mean, I used to live in my car and eat peanut butter out of a spoon, man. Like, I was paying for an extended stay hotel of $60 a day, and I was paying by the day. So, I mean, there was a lot of moments. I mean, even when I was on Shark Tank, we only had $2 in the bank account because we hadn't received some funding yet from some investors that we had closed deals on. So I was out there with the confidence of a made man with $1.92 in his bank account. I actually had to get somebody to cash at me money to have a celebratory dinner the next day. Because I didn't have it, because I was investing all that money into the business. I had no money for myself. So there was a lot of struggle that's going to come. That's not over. We're on the 20-yard line. A lot of people talking to me like I'm a made man because I was on TV. But, you know, we're on the 20-yard line. We got a long way to go before we get to the end zone.
Dustin G. Bell, co-founder and CEO of Cardio. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's americanarchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessary, though, of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
From KUT and KUTX Studios.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
I love what I do, and a lot of people look up to me and, you know, want to do what I do, and I always tell them, like, yo, it's worth it if you're strong enough. Mm-hmm. How many people are willing to look a six-figure guaranteed biweekly check with great health insurance, 9-to-5, work-life balance, friends, something stable, and say, I would forego all of that to build something, be broke the whole time I'm doing it for a maybe chance that it works out. A maybe chance. Most people don't want to do that, or they think they do, and when they hit their first roadblock, I got a lot of friends and a lot of people who I've met along the journey. I've been working on this pretty much for the better part of 3 years now, and I've had a lot of people who had more money, who had more pedigree, who had better experience, who had better connections, who did not make it as far as I did because they hit their first roadblock. We ran out of money, or I can't find an engineer to join my team at a price I can afford, or none of these investors are biting on this, or this, and that, you know, and they give up.
Dustin G. Bell, co-founder and CEO of Cardio. Becoming an entrepreneur, one has to identify a niche that aligns with their interests and market needs and create a comprehensive business plan. In 2020, the inspiration behind the fitness app was born. Struggling with cardio workouts after graduating from the University of Kentucky during the COVID-19 pandemic, Bell knew he had to do something. This realization prompted him to create an app that would transform a dull exercise into something fun. Cardio is a fitness app turning your outdoor walking and running into a giant team game of turf war. As you track your walks and runs, you claim that area of town with your team, and you can steal or defend it from others walking and running individuals and clubs in your city. Recently, Bell pitched his gamified movement app company in Shark Tank Season 16, Episode 1. I'm John L. Hansen, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Cardio with co-founder and CEO Dustin G. Bell, Part 2, In Black America.
You know, I had several different tiers of how I thought about it. The first tier was just to get on and make good TV. Because one thing that people don't know about Shark Tank also is that there are 160-ish companies, maybe even more than that, that actually go in film. And only about 80 of them will actually make TV. So beyond the process of how difficult it is to even get to the point where you film Shark Tank, to actually get on TV is also like another 50-50. It's a flip of a coin if you're even going to make TV. So my first focus, going back to why I counted at 10%, even though I was cool with 15, is just to make good television. Because I didn't expect to get a deal, or if I did, I didn't think it was going to be a deal I liked or from a shark that I wanted. So I wanted to just make sure that no matter what happens, we're just going to air. The episode is going to make it to TV.
With limited job opportunities after graduating from the University of Kentucky during the pandemic, Dustin G. Bell found himself sleeping on the couch in his father's attic and losing motivation to work out or engage in outdoor cardio. During this time, he came up with an idea for a fitness software. After reflecting on how Pokemon Go gained popularity and demonstrated that those who would not have normally been outside were more willing to do so in a gamified way. Fast forward, he decided to pack up his belongings and move to Austin, Texas, without a job, family, or place to stay. Bell was recently featured in the first episode of Season 16 of Shark Tank. He asked the Sharks for $150,000 in exchange for 5% equity in his company, valued it at $3 million. He secured a deal for $150,000 in exchange for 15% equity in his company. Of course, after this episode aired, the company gained a lot of attention and more people started using the Cardio app. On today's program, we conclude our conversation with Justin G. Bell in studio. So when you came up with the idea, obviously one has to make the app. So who are part of your team?
Yeah, a lot of people. So the funny part is that I talk to people all the time. They're like, yo, how'd you go about executing on this? You know, what skills did you have? What experience did you have? I had none. You know, I'm not an engineer. I went to school for marketing, so I didn't know how to build apps. I never designed apps. I had no money. I was not a runner, so I didn't have a vast experience with running apps. I had never led a team of engineers. I also had no money because I was basically making enough to survive. So it was definitely not enough for me to pay, you know, $10,000 a month for engineers. So I sent a ton of DMs. I sent about 400 DMs over a three-ish month span to a bunch of
DM.
Yeah. Oh, my bad. A direct message. That's what the kids get.
Okay.
The kids
right. get
But a direct message to a bunch of engineers on LinkedIn asking them to, hey, basically quit your job and work with me for free. And all of them said no, obviously, because they're not, you know, idiots. So they all said no. But one of them, you know, connected me with the founder of Pokemon Go. So I reached out to him, sent him a message. He responded. And then long story short, we ended up getting a $50K investment from him and his team at Pokemon Go. And then with that, I was able to then convince my CTO to quit his job.